This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Hello and welcome to this week's show of Property Matters. It's Greg Watson, and here we talk about all things property on the show, although today we are going with a slight leaning towards rental properties for tenants and landlords. The reason for that? It's the 1st of July, and this is the day that rental properties must comply with healthy home standards, and here's what that means. This article by Michael Daly on Stuff. We'll just pop in and see what he has to say about this. So today, that is Tuesday, July the 1st, at the time of recording, is the last day by which rental properties have to comply with the Healthy Home Standard that were introduced in 2019, and they've been implemented progressively since. The standards set minimum requirements with some exemptions for heating, insulation, ventilation, moisture and drainage, and draft stopping in residential rental properties. So we might just look at the reasoning behind this, why they were introduced. When the standards were introduced in 2019, then Minister of Housing and Urban Development Phil Twyford said nearly 600,000 households lived in rented homes. The rental stock was of poorer quality than owner-occupied homes. It was estimated about 200,000 families lived in rental homes that did not have ceiling or underfloor insulation, Twyford said. Each year, 6,000 children had housing-sensitive hospitalisations. These children have been found to be nearly four times more likely to be re-hospitalised and 10 times more likely to die in the following 10 years, Twyford said. Sounds like a good reason to get this done to me. So what are the minimum standards? Well, heating, just to recap, the landlords must provide one or more acceptable fixed heaters that can directly heat the main living room. So if you're a tenant, that's an important thing there, to be able to heat that main living room. Not necessarily the whole house, unfortunately. The website of government agency Tenancy Services said that in most cases, the acceptable types of heaters would be larger fixed heating devices, such as a heat pump, wood burner, pallet burner, or flued gas heater. In some cases, such as small apartments, a smaller fixed electric heater might be enough. But there are certain things that you can't have, or that don't comply, I should say. One of those is an open fire, that is just your classic old fireplace, or an unflued combustion heater. Sort of makes sense, you need that smoke to go somewhere. And an unflued combustion heater, for example, as well as a portable LPG bottle heater. Do you remember those in the old days? Those ones you'd wheel from room to room, they had the gas bottle in, really bad for you sort of thing. If you're using those, I'd strongly suggest not to. And just out of interest, Tenancy Services noted that the World Health Organization recommends a minimum indoor temperature of 18 degrees Celsius. If you're ever wondering, as a minimum for a nice living environment. I think we all know from living or growing up in New Zealand that the homes are very cold inside, generally speaking. When it comes to heating, there are some complicated options, like getting a professional to calculate the heating capacity in the main living room. Insulation, ceiling and underfloor insulation has been compulsory in all rental homes where practical since July 2019. And in some cases, upgrading or replacement was needed to meet the Healthy Home Standards. They have some stats around that. We won't go into that right now. But suffice to say that it's to do with how well it keeps the heat in. Ventilation. Rental homes must have windows that can be opened in the living room, dining room, kitchen and bedrooms. Kitchens and bathrooms must have extractor fans or an acceptable continuous mechanical ventilation system. Moisture ingress and drainage. This is a lot to do with avoiding dampness, which Tenancy Services said can lead to poor health for tenants and cause damage to a house. Stormwater, surface water and groundwater must all be efficiently drained to an appropriate outfall. The drainage system must include appropriate gutters, downpipes and drains to remove water from the roof. If there is a gap between the floor of the house and the ground and that space is substantially enclosed by some sort of cladding or wall, a ground moisture barrier is required, and the aim of this is to stop dampness rising from the ground into the house. However, it did say, well, the tenancy services do say that tenants also have some responsibilities, and that includes keeping the house in a condition that doesn't encourage mould and damp. So open the windows and doors whenever you can, and open the curtains during the day. Activities like cooking, bathing or drying clothes create moisture. To remove this from the house, open windows and use any extractor fans. So it's actually a joint responsibility, the ventilation and moisture control. Draft stopping. Landlords must block any unreasonable gaps or holes in walls, ceilings, windows, floors and doors that cause noticeable drafts. And that seems fairly common sense, really. Now, what should you do if you're renting and you think the home you're renting doesn't meet the standards? Complaining to Tenancy Tribunal is not the first option. The first thing you should do is talk to the landlord. If you can't come to an agreement, a tenant could give a landlord a notice to remedy, giving the landlord a reasonable amount of time to get the work done. If the landlord does not fix the problem in the time allowed, you can apply to the Tenancy Tribunal to sort the matter out, Tenancy Services said. What happens to landlords who don't meet the standards? Well, as of today, they're in breach of the Residential Tenancies Act. Consequences could include financial penalties of up to $50,000 for larger scale landlords who own six or more rental properties, and up to $7,200 for smaller scale landlords. So landlords, you should have done this by now. Hopefully it is done, but if not, get it done as quick as you can. Which leads to the next article by Miriam Bell from the 29th of June. This is from the Sunday Star Times. She asks the question, are landlords ready for the Healthy Homes deadline? And just in brief, she says that landlords have had 6 years to meet the Healthy Home standards, but experts say many of the country's 500,000 rental properties won't make the grade when the final deadline kicks in on Tuesday. The standards, which become law in 2019, set the minimum requirements, and compliance has been phased in over the years, so that the article talks a little bit about that. She says that those working in the field have long warned many properties will not be up to standard by the deadline, and inspection data released over the years have added fuel to the concerns. An example is the Ministry of Housing and Urban Development's most recent survey of landlords' compliance done in January 2024. Now, I must say that's a year and a half ago. So it found that 17% of landlords said they fully met the standards and 73% had not. The ministry spokesperson said a further survey is underway to assess compliance and the results will be made available in the coming months. We expect that by July the 1st, the majority of landlords will be compliant with the standards unless exemptions apply. So how have rental properties been progressing on the road to compliance? The Sunday Star Times talked to some industry experts to find out. Property Inspection Company Better Group collects data on the Healthy Homes inspections it conducts. It analysed 1,000 randomly selected properties from around the country that were inspected between April the 1st and June the 24th to get a snapshot of compliance rates. An analysis shows only 23.2% of those properties achieved an overall compliance pass rate, which means three quarters did not. But when the data for each of the six separate standards was analysed, the picture improved. So the pass rates for heating, insulation and moisture were 83%, 73% and 79% respectively. Drainage and ventilation pass rates were 70% and 67%, and the lowest pass rate was draft stopping at 50%. So therefore, the data can show that if the property received a pass on five of the standards but failed one, it would show up as an overall fail. This data also covers more properties managed by private landlords than properties under the care of property managers, and property managers have been more proactive on complying with the standards. Typically, property managers have been working towards the standards for longer, and the properties they manage tend to be more compliant and of higher quality. So whereas we're seeing a lot of private landlords have left doing the work till the last minute. But the data should provide a decent idea of how progress goes towards compliance as the deadline looms. The pass rates for heating and insulation were pretty high, which proves legislation does work and landlords are responding to the standards. The good news is that landlords are making the effort to get their properties to standard, he says, in hopes that they'll keep maintaining their properties to the required standards. So the article then goes on. I would like to think that the vast majority of homes are now compliant, as they should be. If not, there's the possibility to again, seek remedy from the owner, have a talk to them first, You would then serve a 14-day notice, in my opinion, to rectify the breach of the tenancy law on whatever matter that is. If they haven't fixed it within 14 days, you could apply to tenancy tribunal. So that's probably a good way to move forwards if you were a tenant. Now going to look at a couple of tenancy-related matters, and before we look at the general housing market, etc. This article here from the New Zealand Herald. There's been a bit more methamphetamine in the news. In some areas, it's quite widespread at the moment. This article from Rick Stevens says, Auckland tenant admits causing meth contamination but doesn't have to pay for items thrown away. So a tenant who caused tens of thousands of dollars to a furnished rental property through his methamphetamine use will not have to pay for all the items that had to be thrown out. After two tenancy tribunal decisions in the case, the tenant has had to pay only $3,270 in insurance excesses. But the landlord's agent says contaminated chattels, which had to be thrown away, were not fully covered by insurance, leaving them out of pocket by $18,000. The tribunal says it won't make the tenant pay for this. Just a word of warning for all landlords out there, make sure your insurance does cover everything that it should, because a good insurance policy will see you right. Unfortunately, this sounds like they didn't have contents insurance that allows for methamphetamine contamination. The New Zealand Property Investors Federation Public Relations and Advocacy Manager Matt Ball said the tribunal's late decision in this case was really unfair. It sends a terrible message to tenants. It's essentially saying that you can destroy someone else's property and just walk away, he said. The tenant, who cannot be named for legal reasons, took on the furnished Herne Bay, Auckland apartment in April 2021. He moved out in July 2023. Tests subsequently found methamphetamine contamination many times above levels considered unsafe for human beings. The tenant accepted that his actions had caused the contamination when he appeared before the tribunal. The tribunal decisions did not specify whether he had been the subject of any criminal case regarding the illegal Class A drug. The landlord's agent, Goodwin Realty, said insurance policy covered claims up to a maximum of $15,000, which was far below the actual cost of replacing the large number of items that had to be thrown away as a result of contamination. The agent estimated the replacement value of the contaminated chattels amounted to an extra $18,000. However, the unit's contents had been bought between 2019 and 2020, meaning that by the end of the tenancy, almost all of it was 3 years old. So the tribunal found, referring to Inland Revenue's depreciation guide, that items such as linen, bedding, crockery and cutlery had depreciated to the point where they had no residual value after 3 years. The chattels that did have a value, including an ironing board, dish rack, knife block, a couch, two armchairs, three lamps, the range hood, a mattress and internal shutters and curtains, were now worth a total of $10,836, the tribunal determined. That was below the amount that the landlord's insurance had already agreed to pay out. I'm not persuaded that I should order the tenant to make any further payment to the landlord, tribunal member Christian Lambden said. There are currently two measures that determine a safe level of methamphetamine contamination in residential properties. In 2017, Standards New Zealand set the level at 1.5 micrograms per 100 square centimetres in high-use areas. However, in 2018, the then Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor Peter Gluckman reported there was a lack of scientific evidence to prove exposure posed a health risk below 15 micrograms. The testing in the Herne Bay house showed what the tribunal said was a very high level of contamination, and that included a level of 49 micrograms in the kitchen exterior fan, and 109 on the lounge ceiling, 69 on the bedroom ceiling, and 195 on the bedroom door. Wow, that is high, in my experience. So methamphetamine testing cost the landlord almost $8,700, and decontamination costs $8,123. These expenses were covered by insurance. The landlord also claimed an unspecified amount for lost rent during the time the unit was being decontaminated. Matt Ball of the Property Investors Federation said the tribunal had said a landlord should not be left better or worse off by its decisions. However, he said the decision resulted in the landlord being left thousands of dollars out of pocket. The tribunal's error in assuming that an asset's tax value is its useful life are the same thing, when clearly they are not. As an example, crockery is depreciated over 3 years, but if well cared for, can last many lifetimes. Ball said the Federation had raised this matter with the tribunal to seek clarification and ideally a change in the way damage was evaluated. If necessary, we'll take this up with Associate Housing Minister Tama Pōtaka, as it as we feel very strongly that a deep unfairness has been established in the system that needs to change, he said. Our advice to investors, especially those providing fully furnished homes, as in this case, is to bear this decision in mind when deciding what chattels to provide when setting rents. Ensure your rent is set at a level that covers the cost of your chattels in a reasonable time, so if the worst happens, your losses are minimised or even fully covered. So interesting. It's the reason that the tribunal, in my view, wouldn't go after that extra money is because tenants are only responsible to pay up to the amount of bond or the insurance excess. And so in this case, that's all they were, all they could order for them to pay. So unfair, I believe so for the landlord, definitely. Okay, here's something for you out of interest. This is a article from the realms of public housing. So this article from Radio New Zealand says, Ōtara kāinga ora tenant evicted after repeatedly abusing agency staff. A kāinga ora tenant has been evicted from his home after repeatedly becoming aggressive and yelling F you at staff when he was told to remove his dogs from the property. The agency applied to end Vene Whanaki's periodic tenancy at the Ōtara house, arguing that he swore at staff and was aggressive and intimidating. But to have Whanaki's tenancy terminated by Tenancy Tribunal, kāinga ora had to show three incidents of antisocial behaviour had occurred in 3 months. According to the tribunal's recent decision, it was able to do so. The first incident occurred in a kāinga ora office in September last year when Whanaki met to discuss his dog allegedly attacking a tradesperson as well as the condition of his property. As the meeting was coming to an end, Whanaki yelled F you at two staff members and continued to use explicit language in the foyer as he left the building. Wow. 2 weeks later, two kāinga ora staff visited the Baird's Room home to check the dogs had been removed as discussed at the earlier meeting. The decision stated Whanaki was aggressive when he answered the door and during the conversation became agitated. He told the pair to F off, the decision noted, describing Whanaki as yelling and being aggressive and intimidating. 1 month later, on the 31st of October, two senior housing support managers visited the property after reports the dogs were still there and again to discuss the condition of the house. Whanaki told the pair he had the dogs and would challenge kāinga ora in court. The decision stated, as the pair left the property, Whanaki used unacceptable language, including yelling at them to F off and waving his arms. Whanaki denied receiving two of the three notices, kāinga ora said it had fixed his front door, as well as leaving a copy in his letterbox after each incident. Tribunal found kāinga ora had provided Whanaki with the necessary written notice after each incident and hadn't acted in a retaliatory way. It ordered the tenancy to be terminated and for Whanaki to be evicted. So when approached by NZME about the case, kāinga ora said it did not comment on tenancy tribunal decisions, but referred to information relating to disruptive behaviour on its website. That information stated that as of July last year, the agency had changed its approach to disruptive behaviour by its tenants. I believe that was partly prompted by the current government. It noted that this included working to understand what's driving the behaviour and referring tenants to specialist social and health services to address underlying issues if needed. However, if the behaviour did not change, it would end tenancies and not offer the tenant another home. The data on its website showed that in the current financial year, 63 tenancies have been terminated without offering the tenant another home, compared to 12 in the year before. I think the view of the government is that they have good people who will respect and live in homes happily, who are on a waiting list, and maybe they are wondering why they should give somebody extra chances who is treating the properties so badly. Here's something a little bit more, well, it's housing related, but it's also work related. And this article is by Amy Rideout. And it says, a man who bought a house 200 kilometres from his office fails to convince his company to allow remote work. After buying a house hours away from his office, the developer asked to work from home, but instead ended up out of a job. Senior developer Nathan Petrie claimed constructive dismissal after his employer, digital agency Alfero, refused to let him work remotely full-time, an arrangement he believed had been established. Employment Relations Authority member Davina Tan's ruling said, Petrie began working at El Fierro near the end of 2021. His manager had explained during the interview process that remote work was not typical and employees were generally expected to be in the office 3 days a week. However, Petrie was working on a team with a more remote focus and worked from home 4 days a week. This coincided with El Fierro offering more flexible working conditions due to COVID-19 conditions, although the company stated this was not forever. At the end of November 2023, Petrie had to find a new home after his houseboat became uninhabitable. In a meeting in December, Petrie told his manager he had an offer accepted on a house in Whanganui, 2.5 hours from Wellington. Tan said the company was disappointed Petrie hadn't told them of his plans to buy a home in another city. His boss considered that it was likely a matter one would raise with their employer prior to purchasing a home in a different town. You would certainly think so. El Fierro told Petrie the company couldn't support full-time remote work and that he could work fully remotely until the end of March while he settled into his new home. El Fierro understood this would be by the end of Petrie's employment, but Petrie saw it differently. Just to be clear, I've not actually resigned yet, Petrie wrote to his manager. If we get to March and I haven't found something, I assume as long as I can get to the office one day per week, current arrangement, I'll still have a job, yes. Obviously, I'm going to try my best because commuting would suck, but I'm going to make sure I'm not going to have the rug pulled out from under me. Petrie reiterated his request to work for the company full-time, asking that his existing arrangement of 4 days remote work be extended to 5. If I'm required to come into the office for any reason, just let me know and I'll make myself available. However, El Fierro told Petrie that after March, they'd be unable to accommodate remote work and needed to be in the office 3 days a week. Petrie resigned at the beginning of March, raising a personal grievance a few days later. The ERA found Petrie's remote working arrangement was temporary and client-specific. El Fierro had not breached its duties and therefore there was no constructive dismissal. Petrie's claims were dismissed. So like I say, slightly housing-related. Don't go buying a house assuming you can work from home without talking to your employer first. Amazing. Now, a little bit about the housing market. Now, just to finish off with, and an article here from interest.co.nz says that mortgage payments on cheaper homes are at their lowest level in almost 4 years. So mortgage affordability for first home buyers continues to improve as mortgage rates and house prices at the bottom of the market both continue a slow but steady decline. According to the Real Estate Institute of New Zealand, the lower quartile selling price was $580,000 in May, down from $599,000 in April. The lower quartile price, and that's the price point at which 25% of sales are below and 75% are above, representing the most affordable end of the market, has declined by $90,000, which is 13.4%, since it peaked in November of 2021. At the same time, mortgage interest rates are tumbling, with the average of the two-year fixed rates offered by the main banks dropping to 5.01% in May, down from more than 7% in late 2023. The combination of lower prices and falling interest rates means the mortgage payments on a lower quartile priced home are now at their lowest level for almost 4 years. So how does this look practically? Interest.co.nz estimates that the mortgage payments on a home purchased at the national lower quartile price of $580,000 with a 10% deposit would be $738 a week. And that's down from $886 in May of last year. That's a saving of $148 per week. So that's really impressive to have that saving over the last 12 months. So it is becoming easier, generally speaking, in that lower quartile. So if you can get on the market there, then that's great. And also leads on to this article from interest.co.nz from Greg Ninnis saying the average price first home buyers are paying for a home has hardly moved since October last year, but record numbers are taking out low equity loans. That means that it's becoming easier to lend. The banks are lending more to first home buyers. Also very good news. So the average amount of first home buyers are paying for a home declined slightly last month, as did the average size of the mortgages they took out to buy their home. So interest.co.nz estimates the average purchase price paid by first home buyers in May this year was $673,000, which is down slightly from $680,000 in April. May's estimated purchase price was of $673,000 was approximately midway between Real Estate Institute of New Zealand's lower quartile selling price of $580,000 in May and the median price of $763,000. When we talk about more people getting low equity loans, they say here that while the prices they are paying for homes appear stable for now, the numbers taking out low equity loans with less than a 20% deposit continue to grow. So you don't necessarily have to have that 20% deposit if your situation is good and the banks are happy. So the latest Reserve Bank figures show that 2,895 mortgages were approved to first home buyers in May. And of those, 12,013, or 41%, were low equity loans. That's a lot. That's, in fact, a new record for low equity lending to first home buyers. So good news there. It's becoming a little easier to lend. If you haven't looked into it in a little while, maybe talk to a mortgage broker and see what's happening there. And that leads us probably just this last comment, this article on stuff.co.nz says, New Zealand property asking prices flat for 2.5 years. And then talks about one region that's the record high, which is actually in Southland. So in the June 2025 property report, the Real Estate Institute of New Zealand is talking about these flat average asking prices. So the national average asking price is down slightly by 0.9% year on year. Vanessa Williams, the spokesperson for realestate.co.nz, described the market as flat rather than stable, noting that while this aids buyer and seller expectations, a more active market is normally a sign of economic recovery. Regional trends vary significantly. As I mentioned, Southland, they're going well. A second record high asking average price of $568,000. That's up 8.6% in a year. In contrast, Northland's prices fell 9.1% in the last year. I don't have figures to hand for our region, but generally speaking, a flat market means that demand hasn't quite got there yet. But as I mentioned in the previous article, if the interest rates are lower, the banks are lending more often, the demand will return to the market. So watch this space. And that's all we have time for here on Property Matters this week. I'm Greg Watson. Thank you to the team at MPR, Manawatu People's Radio. That's mpr.nz. You can find a number of my shows, plus lots of other interesting shows on that website. You can also subscribe to many of them. Also, if you wanted to find this as a podcast, you can do so. Just wherever you find good podcasts, just search for Greg Watson and Property Matters. Thanks again to the editors of this show, and we'll catch up with you again in a week's time.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.